36 in?
There we go. Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's April 3, 2017. A couple of quick announcements. We're going to set over to next week Senate Bill 339 and Senate Bill 664. We've got some amendments pending on those. So we're going to start off then with a work session on Senate Bill 646. We'll open that. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 646 authorized the issuance of lottery bonds sufficient to produce $3 million in net proceeds and earnings for repair and improvement of the docks, marine infrastructure, and facilities owned by the Port of Brooklyn Harbor. There's an emergency clause, so this measure becomes effective July 1st of this year. The measure does have subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, and to that extent, we have received fiscal and revenue impact statements, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 646 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 643 to the Senate floor with a due... 646 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion on the motion. Senator.
Yeah, I'd like to bring one thing up, and that is this is really isn't necessary. They can go right to the committee, get their name on the list. This doesn't give them a leg up with anybody. It just takes a lot of time and money, and I wish they wouldn't do this.
We had that discussion, but so be it. You get to deal with it down there.
I do, and I'll be a yes. Who wants to be against repairing Brookings Harbor? But that's...
just... opportunity to get on the list. Anybody else? Is there any opposition? There's none. It is passed, and we will close on that bill. And we do not have all the paperwork yet for Senate Bill 383, so we'll move on down the list here, and we'll see if we get it by the end of the meeting.
Can we stand at ease for a moment? I'll go get Senator Olson next door.
Okie dokie.
These three bills.
Those are all his.
I know. I heard that. 838, not 383.
That's right.
838? What did I say?
He said 383.
Well, I'm having a little trouble with numbers today.
We knew what you meant. we knew what you meant.
But we got to get it right for the record.
That's right.
What can I say?
You go on Ways and Means.
been there, done that.
Yeah. Don't want to do that anymore.
No, I don't want to do that anymore. We're just waiting for Senator Olson. The next three bills are his.
So are we doing 656, 657, 659?
Well, I'm having trouble with that microphone. Then. Is he coming?
Yes, he is. He'll be here just momentarily, Mr. Chair. There he is.
Here we go. So we open a public hearing on three bills at once here. Senate Bill 656, Senate Bill 657, and Senate Bill 659. Patrick, you want to do an intro quick?
Oh, sure, Mr. Chair. So Senate Bill 656 increases the required frequency of conducting independent management and evaluation of non-governmental entities' operations, efficiency, and effectiveness if public purpose charge monies are transferred to the entity for specified energy efficiency purposes. Senate Bill 657. Reduces the public purpose charge from 3% of total revenues collected to 2% of retail electricity customers. And Senate Bill 659 requires non-governmental entity as condition of receiving public purpose charge monies to be assessed by an independent third party.
Welcome, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee. My name is Senator Alan Olson. I represent Senate District 20. I just Senator Girard, I'm sorry, the heart of Clutcher County. That's just a running joke, Mr. Chair. He always asks me, if I'm the heart of Clackamas County, what's his district? And I said, everything below the belt. In 1999, the Oregon legislature passed an electric industry restructuring law, Senate Bill 1149, with the intent of establishing a stable, consistent funding source for residential, commercial, and industrial electricity efficiency, renewable energy, and market transformation programs. The legislation requires the state's largest investor-owned electric utilities to collect a 3% public purpose charge and authorize the Oregon Public Utility Commission to direct a portion of those funds to an independent, non-government entity, the Energy Trust of Oregon. Energy Trust began operation in March of 2002. And they were charged with investing in cost-effective electric energy efficiency. I'm reaching here to grab some things to pass forward to the committee. Nita? Thank you. Where were we here? Energy Trust began operation in March 2002, charged with investing in cost-effective electric energy efficiency, helping to pay the above-market cost of renewable energy resources, implementing market transformation programs, delivering service with low administrative and program support costs, and maintaining high levels of customer satisfaction. In Energy Trust's short existence, 2002 to the present, their budget has increased from $19,298,527 to $198,600,000. If you do the math, that's 15 years. The 2007 projected budget is a change from the chart showing a projected budget of $176,715,565. This change for 2017 is a 12.4% increase above the original projection and a 28% increase over 2016 income levels. Senate Bill 657 simply reduces the public purpose charge from 3% to 2% and caps total income at $150 million per year if the amendments are accepted, and we've put in an amendment for that amount. These are ratepayers' dollars, exacerbated by Senate Bill 838 of 2009, which allowed utilities to collect additional sums for Energy Trust of Oregon. PGE collects 7.1%, Pacific Power collects 5.9%, Northwest Natural collects 3.2%, Cascade Natural Gas collects 4.3%, and Avista collects 1.1%. If a ratepayer uses both Northwest Natural and PGE, they pay 10.3% of their utility bill to Energy Trust of Oregon. 1% drop in revenue is a small amount, but will be significant as rates continue to rise, as an example, PGE's current rate increase request. Senate Bill 657 simply tries to help ratepayers. Former Senator Rick Metzger, who worked on the creation of Senate Bill 1149, told the Oregonian, and I quote, "We thought they, ETO, might have a $10 to $12 million budget." The 2003 ETO annual report stated, "When fully operational, the Energy Trust expects the public purpose funding to generate approximately $45 million annually." Energy Trust has been the subject of legislative discussions many times in the past. For example, in 2007, legislators wanted to take $4.6 million to pay the debt owed by the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. In 2009, there was legislation to shift $100 million to schools and other public buildings for upgrades. As mentioned earlier, Energy Trust of Oregon is a nonprofit organization. As such, they answer only to the PUC. This body created this taxing authority, and by this body I mean the Oregon Legislature, created the taxing authority, and it should have the opportunity to examine the accounting for Energy Trust. We know that each year Energy Trust provides the PUC with an audited financial statement. Energy Trust also provides their own performance measures. It is appropriate that they review their own books. It is also appropriate to have an outside independent audit of both finances and performance done by a non-biased firm. Senate Bill 659 does just that. It requires that Energy Trust be assessed by an independent third party. Senate Bill 656 increases the frequency of those audits. This is a simple request to allow this body, the legislative body, to make certain that those taxes we have required are providing measurable outcomes. I have not seen reporting by any trust, Energy Trust of Oregon concerning underperforming programs. For example, then Secretary of State Kate Brown stated in a report dated May 2012, quote, our analysis of 6,859 energy efficiency measures from 2002 to 2010 found that school districts did not consistently implement the most cost-effective measures or realize the greatest energy savings. We estimate that had districts implemented the top-ranked measures instead, they could have potentially have achieved almost $40 million more in anticipated district utility bill savings and gained an additional 70% energy reduction over the collective lives of the measures compared to the estimated results of those measures that were actually implemented. Another example is the $500,000 that was given to a solar panel project in Christmas Valley that was never built. Does Energy Trust report these deficiencies, or do they report the expected savings that the investments are supposed to provide? Performance audits will provide this information. Once again, Senate Bill 659 and Senate Bill 656 will provide the transparency required. We only need to look back in time at other agencies and programs that failed. The list is long and embarrassing. History does repeat itself. I ask that you support these bills so that we, as the highest oversight body, can make certain that ratepayers are receiving the benefits they are told about but pay for in blind ignorance. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Questions? I don't see any.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. All righty. So we have a list here. Janice Thompson. Welcome.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. I am Janice Thompson, Advocacy Director with the Oregon Citizens Utility Board, or CUB. We were created over 30 years ago by a ballot measure with a focus on residential ratepayer advocacy. Much of our work is in the regulatory arena, but also the legislative efforts as well. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. CUB opposes these three bills. Senate Bill 656 and 659 have a similar focus on Energy Trust of Oregon, or ETO, accountability. CUB would have never supported Senate Bill 1149 and the creation of ETO in the first place without adequate accountability safeguards regarding its board and oversight by the Public Utility Commission, or PUC. In our view, the current safeguards are adequate and effective. For example, low administrative costs have always been important to CUB, and in our comments on ETO's annual budget, we are consistently pleased to see that their costs, administrative costs, are consistently below the level set by the PUC. Given this history, we see no compelling reason for either of these two bills. Indeed, it's important to note that the bills will increase administrative costs and, in our view, unnecessarily divert ratepayer dollars from carrying out the energy efficiency and other projects that provide benefit to individual customers, but are really important to note, provide benefits to all customers when the utilities avoid having to pay for higher cost electricity. As I mentioned, much of CUB's work is in the regulatory arena, and those efforts enable us, I think, to make another key point, which is the PUC oversight of ETO is far more rigorous than PUC oversight of any of Oregon's investor-owned utilities. CUB's regulatory work also includes active participation in the Integrated Resource Planning, or IRP, process, and in that setting, we push both the utilities and ETO to ensure that ratepayers are getting the most out of their energy efficiency and other investments. So moving on to Senate Bill 656, the bill that lowers the public purpose charge and caps ETO funding. CUB's opposition to this bill is grounded in our firm belief that it really benefits all customers for the utilities to address their energy needs through cost-effective energy efficiency and renewable investments. So, for example, for every dollar ETO invests in energy efficiency, all ratepayers save $3. If energy efficiency investments above that $250 million level are possible but don't occur because of the proposed cap, all ratepayers lose because the utilities are forced to use higher cost resources. Indeed, the recent Coal to Clean bill requires that the two utilities, Portland General Electric and Pacific Power, acquire all cost-effective energy efficiency, which, and so if this cap is in place, I think there's also going to be some detrimental impact on achieving that legislation's greenhouse gas reduction goals. The cap seems particularly kind of imprudent now, because as economic growth does continue, we're just in this point of time with potential for some new major construction projects or major renovations, and that seems like it increases the possibility of hitting that $250 million cap. So again, that would be detrimental for ratepayers as well as the owners of those kinds of new facilities, who would be stuck with higher operating costs compared to lower operating costs if the projects, renewable or energy efficiency projects that could have been completed in partnership with ETO, are hindered by the cap. So just two quick examples of ETO projects. One's a healthcare center providing nursing care for veterans in Lebanon that combined energy efficiency steps in lighting, appliances, heating and cooling with rooftop solar. The second example is actually right in my own personal neighborhood in Portland. Vigor Industrial renovated its Swan Island shipbuilding yards with energy-efficient LED lights that provide ongoing savings in their operating costs, and had a very helpful kind of double benefit because it also improved worker safety. So these are the types of projects that we're concerned could be stopped by a cap on ETO resources, again, to the detriment of ratepayers whose lower public purpose charge would, I think, be offset by the cost to them of losing system-wide benefits in terms of ETO making these kinds of investments to the benefit of all ratepayers. So with all due respect, CUB opposes these bills and requests that they don't move forward.
Thank you. Questions?
I have one.
The Senator.
Are you the least bit concerned of the magnitude of how much this raises now versus what it was designed to when it was initiated? Metzger is on record as saying he was thinking it would be 10 to 12 million, and it's looking like it's about $200 million now.
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, I think the bottom line is the projects that have been funded are cost-effective and have system-wide benefits. So if it turns out that there are more of those projects and more of those benefits, then I don't know that, you know, some early estimates as to the size of the overall project should be a governing factor.
Any others? Thank you, Janice. J.L. Wilson and John Charles. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. And members, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. We've got about 160 facilities here in Oregon with 170,000 employees as part of our membership. I think this, I'm speaking academically in support of the concept of Senate Bill 657. I think the perception exists among our industrial customers that ETO is becoming awash in resources with a sort of a finite universe of cost-effective energy efficiency projects out there. And so just I would say principally with respect to 657, I think it is well within your purview to match up the taxing mechanism and the revenue it generates with the mission and the outcomes of the ETO. Since 2005, You've got industrial rates of PGE increasing around 20%. Pacific Coast industrial rates have increased about 50%. You can see that there would be a commensurate increase in revenues to the ETO. And this is just industrial customers. We pay a 3%. And keep in mind, our bills are in the millions of dollars. This is real money to these types of manufacturers and employers in Oregon. So 3% for us, this does not even account for the commercial and residential ratepayers who pay a more uncapped amount because they have the 838 additions. And so you hear some at 7.1, some at 5.9. We're at 3. For industrials, and so I'm not even necessarily arguing that industrials should be lowered. I'm just saying somebody else should be lowered, and we ought to be able to match up the taxing mechanism and the revenue with the mission and the outcomes, and I think that this conversation is becoming a right conversation.
Thank you. Jill, I guess I have a question for you. The customers that you represent under the statute don't have to pay the 3% directly. If they choose to, they have the option of directing that investment on conservation or efficiencies in their own operations. So, I mean, if they're concerned with the ETO getting too big, why don't they just do that?
They certainly do. Thank you, Chair Beyer. There certainly is a self-direct mechanism, and so many do opt to do that. I think one of the problems we see is, for instance, 2 years ago, you know, for those that don't self-direct, we fought legislation that purported to increase the public purpose charge at on industrial customers, and we were totally unsupportive of that because we think it diminishes what we're able to do. But still, I think that the larger discussion is one of the taxing structure, what you're asking people to pay, and the mission and the outcomes of the organization. And I can just tell you from our member standpoint, there is a strong perception that the ETO has more resources than it knows what to do with. And I think that it's within your purview to look at that.
So let me ask you another question. I mean, obviously, the biggest concern for everyone is rates going up too fast. If new power generation costs on average about 5 and 5.5 cents a kilowatt hour, and the ETO can reduce that demand at 2 cents a kilowatt hour, wouldn't that be a good thing?
Certainly. I wouldn't argue that.
Are you arguing that they're not doing that?
I'm just arguing. What I'm saying is, I believe that it's in the committee's purview to be able to talk about the taxing mechanism, how you're the public purpose charge, and the mission of the ETO, and whether the two are in sync. And so, while I would argue that the ETO is certainly accomplishing its mission, I still think it's within your purview to discuss this because our members are clearly under the impression that the ETO has more resources than it knows how to manage with finite amount of cost-effective energy efficiency to be achieved.
Okay, thank you. Senator?
Yeah, a little bit to your comment. It's kind of a curve. The first dollars save quite a bit of money, and at the end, where the marginal dollars would be, the question would be, are you actually saving as much as it's costing? And I think that's something that we should look at.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute. I have one-page testimony on your OLIS, which I suggest you look at because it has a chart, which is the whole point of my testimony. you may recall that the original public purpose charge was to run 10 years, March 2002 to March 2012. And as such, it didn't concern me all that much. I thought, how much could go wrong? It's only 10 years, and then it goes out of business. But naturally, as with most subsidy streams in the legislature, they're very, it's very unlikely they actually die off. So in Senate Bill 838, back in 2007, buried deep in the bowels of the bill, the public purpose charge was extended to 2026 with very little conversation, virtually no evidence of any kind. So I began to take much greater interest in this. And in the last 5 years in particular, I've probably attended about 30 ETO board meetings. I've read thousands of pages of consultant reports. And I'm interested not just in ETO, I'm interested in all of the public purpose charge administrators, which includes OHCS and school districts. And you may recall getting some of these reports. They come every 2 years to you from the independent third-party consultants, report to the Legislative Assembly on public purpose expenditures. They're probably the least read reports in the building. But if you're a data nerd, they're actually quite interesting. And the chart that I have in front of you comes from reading all these reports, showing that the ratio of energy benefits to cost since inception has been steadily declining across all administrators. ETO conservation is down 40%, ETO renewables down 88%. School districts and OHCS have actually always been pretty much bad deals. And even self-directs have dropped, which is not surprising. There's only 100 entities in the self-directs. One would think if they have a chance to do conservation projects, they're going to do the best ones early on, and after a while, in a universe of 100, there's just not that much left to do. So my conclusion from this chart is not that the program is failing. I think you should look at it in a more positive way. You know, we were doing these things for 30 years prior to the public purpose charge being implemented. After now 15 years, not 10 years, I think you can say the mission has been accomplished. Okay, you could just say it's time to give out some gold watches, thank people for their service, terminate the program, declare victory, and move on. It's not a failure. It's a success. I think they're running out of things to do. I'm particularly interested in Senate Bill 657. I think if you simply reduce the 2%, all the administrators will have less money, which would be a good thing. Certainly ETO has a backdoor around it anyway. You may recall under Senate Bill 838, they're allowed to go to the PUC and negotiate a whole separate increment for just their conservation program. And in their budget for this year, they're anticipating that increment will actually be bigger than the public purpose charge. But for the other administrators, I'm not aware that they have that ability. They would simply be ramping down their program. And I think if next biennium you ramped it down another percent and you terminated it in 2021, I think that would be something actually that ought to happen more often around this building, which is that some programs, you know, there's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end, and you reallocate resources to other things. So my suggestion is that you certainly support at least 657 and begin to pay a little closer attention to this program, which in my personal view, having also attended some PUC hearings on this, I would say it does not get a lot of really detailed scrutiny. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen. And let's see, Ricky, and let's see, who else do I have here? Jeff Bissonnette. Where's Jeff?
You're up. Do you want me to get started? Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Ricky Seguin. I work as the policy director with Renewable Northwest. We're a regional renewable energy advocacy organization. And I'm here today in opposition to Senate Bills 656, 657, and 659, in particular with the implications for Energy Trust of Oregon. Energy Trust plays a critical role in helping the state lead in energy efficiency and renewable energy. The organization is transparent, effective, efficient, and well-managed, delivering on its mission to implement cost-effective energy efficiency programs and new renewable resources. All three of these bills limit the trust's ability to do this important work. Focusing on Senate Bills 656 and 659, both looking at the accountability of the organization, both have ETO pay for additional audits and reports, taking money away from important energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. Both of these proposals are solutions in search of a problem. As the OPUC, the Public Utility Commission, effectively oversees the Energy Trust of Oregon and directs the organization to keep its administrative expenses down. In 2015, the Energy Trust reported its administrative and program support costs at 5.5%, well below the 8% maximum prescribed by the Commission. If ETO were to exceed this maximum, the Commission has broad authority to initiate corrective action. And now on Senate Bill 657, which lowers the public purpose charge and caps the Energy Trust's funding. This reduces the trust's future ability to help support the renewable and energy efficiency programs. I asked Energy Trust of Oregon how they anticipated that Senate Bill 657 would impact their 2017 budget. What I got back was a projection that it would result in a $21.6 million reduction, $4.9 million reduction for renewables, and $16.7 million for energy efficiency. At a time when the state is leading on clean energy, as we get statements from the governor with her commitment, we should not cut back on the organization's ability to do this important work. So for those reasons, I'm here in opposition to those three bills. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Bissonnette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. The solar industry gets a portion of the ETO incentive money for helping consumers install solar on their rooftops and on their businesses. And in some cases, we're seeing increasingly some large-scale solar development being assisted by the Energy Trust. As you've probably heard up till now, the Energy Trust is, you know, extremely effective, and what they are doing is standing in the place of the utility for small-scale renewable development and particularly energy efficiency. Over the course of the 15 or so years that they've been in existence, they have acquired and helped to incent the production of clean energy to the tune of several hundred megawatts. And what they've done is essentially built a virtual power plant and have done it at a cost that is much less than a traditional power plant would have cost. Energy efficiency is always the cheapest resource, basically capping the ability of the Energy Trust to go and acquire the cheapest resource will have an upward impact on ratepayers' rates. In terms of the management audit report, as you know, Energy Trust already has an internal requirement to do a management report every 5 years. One of the bills in question, I think, reduces it to two, and it just doesn't leave time to implement any changes, evaluate the changes, and make other changes. You can spend so much time sort of running the business, not actually doing your business. And the Energy Trust does an especially effective job at its business, and at a very low cost for ratepayers. Lastly, I'll just say that if the Energy Trust didn't exist. You heard earlier of all of the utility service territories it operates in. Operates in PGE, Pacific Power, Northwest Natural, Cascade, and now or soon to be Avista. If the Energy Trust didn't exist and sort of coordinating all those services, each utility would have to operate their own office to do what the Energy Trust does. And that would be a higher and less effective and less efficient impact for ratepayers. And so the Energy Trust has done a very good job for ratepayers, has done a very good job for the solar industry, and I urge you to put these bills aside and continue to let the ETO with effective PUC oversight continue its work. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Jeff. Questions? Senator?
Thank you, Chair Barr. The question I have, Mr. Charles brought up a good point. We've spent a tremendous amount of money trying to get more and more efficient. When have we met our objective? Or is this just going to be an ongoing thing for the next 200 years where we keep expending more and more money?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, I think the answer is when efficiency is higher than the next resource, then we stop acquiring it and you build. But when you can purchase efficiency at a couple of cents a kilowatt hour, and your next available resource, even with low gas prices, is 3 and 4 cents a kilowatt hour, that's still cheap, and you need to continue to pursue the cheapest resource. The thing to understand is that the funds to acquire efficiency have always been in rates. They probably always will be in rates. The difference is that never have they been so effective as going through the Energy Trust and actually acquiring them at massive amounts. I remember when the Energy Trust first acquired 20 megawatts in 1 year of efficiency, and that had never ever been done before. It was mind-blowing. And then the next year they did it again, the next year they did it again, and then they got to the point when they were acquiring 50 megawatts of efficiency. The thing is, it's the cheapest resource, and so as long as it's the cheapest resource, that's what we ought to spend money on.
Well, to follow up, and I'm not standing by this data, but the chart that he presented, there's a couple areas like school districts and OHCS low income is less than a one-to-one return. So you're asking when you stop. My point is when it's less than a one-to-one return, mm-hmm. You should stop. So in those two areas, now in ETO conservation, it's still 3.4, okay, to one, which is pretty good, but government usually operates around 5 or better, but that's still not bad. So you kind of answered your own question. In some of these, I think that we should be looking at cutting back because the efficiencies really aren't there, if his data is correct.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, actually in highlighting...
Because you're not part of the ETO.
Yeah, I was going to say, highlighting the low income and the schools, neither of those go through the ETO. For low income, there is kind of a social service component, so you're basically helping people... reduce their energy usage that hopefully helps them keep their bills under control over time. And you can do that pretty efficiently. I think it is pretty efficient when you're doing that at a time when there is low gas prices. That does make it a little bit more expensive, but you are also, there's also a social service component to it as well. With the schools, it's that's also done through another agency, and again, done in conjunction with energy audits that were done a number of years ago. Maybe we need to update those.
More?
Well, I could get the ETO renewables, which is part of ETO, mm-hmm. is only at 1.6. That, to me, is not a super good ratio by any stretch. And even the ETO conservation at 3.4 for a public entity, that isn't a super good ratio either. So the question is, at the margin, the last dollars we're spending, this is for those are numbers are predicated on an average, so the last numbers we're spending may very well be on the negative side. Do you have anything to prove that the last dollars we're spending are spent at a ratio better than 1 to 1?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, for on the renewable side, the mission is different than on the efficiency side. For the renewable side, what the ETO is doing is buying down the above market costs. They're not covering all of the above market costs, but they're trying to figure out how much they can do to help investment sort of over the hump, if you will. The Energy Trust used to do a lot of support of wind. Wind is now pretty cost-effective. They don't do a lot of wind. We're talking about a day that's not that far into the future, at least, you know, it's not a year, and it's not probably 8 or 9 years, somewhere in between, where solar is not going to have an above-market cost. And so for renewables, when it doesn't have an above-market cost, that's when the ETO pulls out. Again, for efficiency, you're mixing very cheap industrial sector efficiency with a little bit more expensive residential efficiency and sort of mixing it all together. Again, still the cheapest resource, and again, still at a cost with very low administrative overhead.
More?
I'm good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all that I had signed up. Does anybody else wish to address this bill? If not, Mr. Eisdorfer. We would invite you to come forward. So, heard a lot.
Yes.
So, can you describe for the committee what would happen? I think Jeff is going to do this. In terms of what's in statute now, if we did away with the public purpose charge, what would be the responsibility of the utilities under current law?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jason Eisdorfer, Utility Program Director of the Public Utility Commission. Chair Beyer, as the most cost-effective resource, energy efficiency, we wouldn't stop the program. The utilities would be required to acquire all cost-effective energy efficiency, the same as the Energy Trust does now. So Senator Girod is correct in one sense, is that for some of the programs, the cost per unit is going up. The value is coming down, but it's still cost-effective. And the commission holds to its cost-effectiveness test pretty carefully. We check that out pretty thoroughly. So the energy efficiency components are the most cost-effective resource, and ultimately that is the highest value to the ratepayer. The point that the mission is accomplished and there's not that much to do, the Northwest Power and Conservation Council in its seventh plan identified 4,000 average megawatts of energy cost-effective energy efficiency over the next 20 years. The mission is not yet complete and may never be. We ought not to think about energy efficiency as something that you acquire and then you're done with it. It is always, almost always available. And if we don't acquire the cost-effective energy efficiency, we are by definition acquiring more expensive generation.
One of the things that the Senator Olson raised is he noted he was adding into his comments Senate Bill 838. Could you talk about how that relates to the public purpose charge?
Mr. Chair, 838 was the renewable portfolio standard in 2007, but it also had somewhere toward the back, it said, on top of the public purpose charge, to the extent that there is available cost-effective energy efficiency, the utilities through the Energy Trust have to go acquire it. So 838 is really the element that says go out and get cost-effective energy efficiency, because again, that is the.
But wasn't that an option for the utilities? It wasn't a directive. It was they could apply to the commission to ask for that.
Mr. Chair, so that's a yes and a no. They could apply to the commission, but if they didn't, they would have to explain to the commission why they weren't going out and prudently acquiring all cost-effective energy efficiency. So if they were smart, and they are attempting through the Energy Trust to acquire as much cost-effective energy efficiency as they can. And Mr. Chair, if I could, I mean, there's really two issues I think that these three bills raise. One is lowering the public purpose charge, and that goes to the conversation we're having now. Is that really the right thing to do? The two electrics have their annual annual revenue requirement is significantly in excess of $3 billion. And so when we start talking about percentages in the larger scheme of things, this looks like a lot of money, and it is, but it's also it is also the investment to make in order to keep rates low. The other push, I think, on these three bills is more oversight, it sounds like, moving the five-year performance audit to 2 years. We don't regulate the energy trust like we regulate the utilities, but we regulate the heck out of the energy trust. We have this list of places where we touch the energy trust, through performance measures, to a grant agreement, to management meetings that we have every 2 months. Me and my management staff sit down with the energy trust management staff. The reports that we require of them, we require the annual financial audit, the evaluations of programs as they occur, and then the five-year performance audit. The five-year performance audit is no small thing. It turns the energy trust inside out. For a period of 6 months, the energy trust staff is responding to a pretty significant 360-degree review of their activities. I guess I'm a little concerned that doing that every other year would take their attention away from what they do best. I think Mr. Bissonnette mentioned that the Energy Trust was up to 550 average megawatts of energy efficiency. They in 2016, they acquired 60 average megawatts of energy efficiency, which is pretty stunning for the state of Oregon. So what I would like to do is convey to you the value that the Commission sees in the Energy Trust and in cost-effective energy efficiency, but also the numerous points of contact, the numerous demands that the Commission places on the Energy Trust. It's transparent. A lot of it is on the web, their website and our website. And even to the point of looking at their budget on an annual basis.
Do you happen to recall, Jason, what the last five-year review cost? I mean, that's always done through an independent auditor.
Mr. Chair, I don't remember what that cost, but it was not insignificant, the cost of the audit itself.
$20,000,
$30,000? I can't tell you. I can get back to you.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in answering the chair's question, I heard nothing's going to change. We're going to keep doing this. And then I heard a lot of reasons why it would change. Can you straighten that out for me? Because the first thing you said was if the Energy Trust goes away, we'll continue the programs. And then, but it sounds like you're advocating to keep the Energy Trust.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, in theory, we would require all of the utilities to then reinvest in their own energy efficiency programs. That means hiring a whole bunch of folks. There would be, frankly, disjointed energy efficiency programs as opposed to a centralized, coordinated version, which is the Energy Trust.
Thank you.
Senator?
Yeah, my concern, though, is just the scope that this program's become. You know, you have the chair of this committee prior to the good chair that we have now, saying that he expected it to be no more than $12 million. And look at the size and scope that we have now. So, and like I said, Mr. Charles's ratios, if they're accurate, I mean, the benefit, the cost-benefit analysis has gone from an average well over 6 to down just slightly over 3. It seems like on the margins we're not getting as much as we could be, and therefore I just think that going from 3 to 2% might be something that we could do. However, if you can show me at the margins we're still doing 3.4, which I doubt very much, or that these charts aren't accurate, then I think you've made your case. But that's where I am at.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ryan, and again, in theory, the value of those programs don't disappear for the ratepayer until they go under one. So I do agree with you that there are the Energy Trust. Frankly, the Energy Trust has done a spectacular job over the last 15 years and has acquired an enormous amount of cost-effective energy efficiency. So there is naturally some of those programs are going to be more expensive than they used to be. But as long as they're still better than one, they're an excellent value for the ratepayer.
Well, better than one. I have to tell you that, you know, in social services, there's a lot of things that pencil between 6 and 8 that we can't afford. So since this is a tight budget, when you get down to 1 to 1, and that's or $1.01 compared to 1, that doesn't do a whole lot for me. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator Gerard, the comparison isn't the cost in one. Obviously, in one sense, it's the cost-benefit analysis that we're looking at here, but it's also the difference between making an investment here or necessarily making an investment somewhere else. So as load grows 1-1.5% per year, the load needs to be served. And so the question is, do you serve it at with a resource that is better than 1-to-1 or something that is more expensive? And so that's why, as long as it's 1-to-1 and it's less expensive than acquiring the next resource, we acquire it.
I've said my piece.
Huh? Well, I think to your point, one of the issues, if you were going to reduce it under the structure, you probably would reduce the additional amount requested by the utilities first. Because that's their perception of what's the cheapest way to go. The 3%'s there, and then you have on top of that a request by the utilities saying, requesting the PUC to add on to that for conservation because they view it as cheaper as they do their integrated resource plan than buying the next resource. So that would be where you wouldn't reduce the public purpose charge first, should reduce the others. And the context on which that is taken is really within the context of building the integrated resource plan, which the trust works together with the utilities and saying how best to meet their things.
That's right. Mr. Chair, the reason they haven't brought that number down, the 838 funding, is because the utilities and the utilities and the energy trust can work together to try to figure out what the amount of cost-effective energy efficiency is.
Any further questions?
No.
That's it.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Close that hearing.
Yeah. I didn't see anybody else on the list. We're going to go ahead and close the hearing.
Mr. Chair,
656.
We do this one next.
978.
979.
979.
That wasn't there. It's on the
back side. We're going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 979.
Shall I, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you. Senate Bill 979 establishes the ability of retail electricity customers purchase electricity generated by eligible renewable energy resources and certain ancillary services directly from an entity that is not a distribution utility, provided that the entity meets specified conditions. It changes the requirement for the entity that is not a distribution utility from which a retail electricity customer may purchase electricity. The measure becomes effective January 1st, 2018, and takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die.
Bring nursery up.
This panel right here, Mr.
This one? Let's see. We have a Bob Kahn, Letha Tanya. Boy, no wonder the chair butchers these names. You can't even read them. And somebody, Sangus? Sanger? Do you know who you are?
We know.
Just
who we
come
are.
Up, would you?
Everybody in the room knows.
You guys write worse than I do.
Normally people get my first name butchered.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is this on?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today. We're here to describe Senate Bill 979. I have with me Iron Sanger of Sanger Law.
Sure doesn't look like that.
I could have someone else come up if I don't look like
okay.
that.
And Letha Tawney, who is here on behalf of the World Resources Institute, to not to endorse the bill, but to describe the context of the bill. So let me start, and thank you very much. I want to begin by clarifying what might be a matter of some confusion. It is not NPSE's intent to include consumer-owned utilities in this legislation. It's their choice if they choose to offer renewable direct access, as described in the bill, but it is not a requirement. Today is the demonstration of the power of two ideas, a relatively old idea and a relatively new idea. The relatively old idea is Senate Bill 1149, which was passed in 1999 after the result of a considerable amount of collaboration by all the stakeholders in the utility power sector. It created the opportunity for consumers to choose who would supply their electricity. The relatively new idea, and I think it's most exciting, is corporate America's genuine interest in going 100% renewable. You will hear from many supporters today, including representatives of some major national corporations, about their commitment to choose to do 100% renewable for the supply of their electricity needs. And you will also hear from advocates who are making it possible for these companies to go in that direction. You also should see on OLIS a really good number of letters documenting the same interest. So today you have the prospect of matching voluntary choice and renewable power above and beyond the RPS, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, and matching with a statute that 1149 that needs retooling to make that possible. To make it possible for commercial and industrial customers to reach their goals. So just to call out some of the examples of problems that require retooling if this program is going to proceed is, for instance, under current direct access policies, new industries coming to Oregon must pay exit fees to a utility that has not yet served them. Another problem. Electricity service suppliers, which were created under Senate Bill 1149, must pay for the renewable portfolio standard requirements of the local utility, as well as providing for the RPS compliance that they are required to meet as they subsume the utility's RPS requirements. In other words, they're forced to double pay. I'm describing current direct access policies. Another problem, the utilities are required to acquire generation in the event that a direct access customer returns to cost of service, that is traditional utility service, within 5 years. All of these add to the costs of exiting from the utility cost of service and make it virtually, maybe not impossible, but extremely difficult to justify the bottom line investment being made. And then another problem, there are a number we could go into, but this is the fourth, I'll leave it at this, is that Portland General Electric assesses exit fees for 5 years, while PacifiCorp requires 10 years worth of exit fees collapsed into 5 years. So one shouldn't be too surprised that PacifiCorp territory has only 3% of its eligible consumer and industrial customers on the existing direct access program, where Portland General is doing better at 17%. Senate Bill 979 updates Senate Bill 1149 only to the extent to allow for 100% voluntary renewable direct access. It would make it cost-effective while protecting existing ratepayers who remain on cost of service. And you will hear the utilities assert that Senate Bill 979 is bad for their customers. The bill is not bad for the customers of these investor-owned utilities, although it may be not advantageous to their shareholders. Keep in mind The utilities are rewarded under the regulatory compact for the addition, expansion of their capital assets. And this, for them, means that more is better. Whereas for ratepayers, or in this case, ratepayers who choose to leave cost of service, less is better. And having the option to choose how your electricity is produced is critical to the success, the economic development potential of many customers. Mr. Chairman, the moment, Mr. Vice Chairman, Chairman.
Not the chairman.
Senate Bill 979 is significant legislation based on existing proven statutes. I would like to suggest that when we hear concerns, and we expect to, and if these concern the committee, we'd be willing to discuss a possible cap on the program, and at the chair's discretion, define that hold that for a 24-month period consistent with existing PUC policy describing the caps on the existing direct access program. I'd be happy to take any questions and look forward to dialogue today.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. I'm Letha Tawney. I'm the Director for Utility Innovation at the World Resources Institute. The World Resources Institute is a nonpartisan, nonprofit environmental research institution based in Washington, D.C. I have the pleasure of working remotely from Portland, so can join you today. I lead the Charge Initiative at WRI, which works to unleash the buying power of the Fortune 500 in support of an affordable and rapid transition to a low-carbon future. WRI has collaborated with these brands since the early 2000s to help them maximize the positive impact of their purchasing choices. 89 global brands have now committed to transition to 100% renewable energy globally through the RE100 campaign. There are a variety of analyses, but at least 71 of the U.S. Fortune 100 have sustainability or carbon reduction goals that touch their energy use as a company. This focus on clean energy is now mainstream in corporate America, stretching from high tech to big pharma, from retail to manufacturing. Brands with a substantial footprint in the Pacific Northwest have made their goals clear as well. As the New York Times reported last Thursday, changes in federal policy are not dissuading these companies as they plan for the long term. In the United States, WRI has co-convened 65 companies around six principles, the Corporate Renewable Energy Buyers Principles, that describe how they would like to purchase renewable energy. These 65 companies alone need to procure 48 million megawatt hours of renewable energy by 2020, the equivalent of doubling the national wind fleet, to meet their public goals. This is part of the Renewable Energy Buyers Alliance, where our collective goal together is to enable 60 gigawatts of purchases by 2025. The principles articulate a few key attributes that customers are seeking, but let me highlight briefly the new projects principle as it relates to Oregon. Customers are seeking to go beyond the regulatory burden they bear as ratepayers and deliver net reductions to greenhouse gas emissions. This leadership is often called additionality. They're seeking to make an additional contribution above and beyond what regulation will deliver alone. They want to demonstrate to their stakeholders that their purchase was material to the global carbon budget, to local air pollution, to the sustainability and economic strength of the community that they're a part of. In both New York, in the context of the 50% clean energy standard, and in Washington State, in the context of the new clean air rule, these buyers have made it clear they strongly value the opportunity to meet their regulatory burden and then go beyond it, ensuring additional reductions over and above the state goal or cap. Thank you for your time.
Thanks. Oh, that's it?
Yeah, I was just here to take bullets if you had any.
Great. Thank you.
Everybody needs someone to do that.
That's right. A little insurance is good. Our second panel, come on down. Chris Hendricks, Joni Dutz, and Linda Gardner.
Deutsch.
Yeah, they're here. They know who they are. Thank you. Who's first?
I'll go.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair, members of the committee. Joni Deutsch, Executive Director for the Northwest for TechNet, here today in support of Senate Bill 979. TechNet represents the nation's leading technology companies, and we are proud to support Senate Bill 979 for its promotion of customer choice, support for innovation and empowerment, and a step forward. And a step forward in bringing Oregon energy policy to the 21st century. The high-tech industry in Oregon is committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and expanding the use of renewable energy in the near term. Customer choice for electricity, commonly referred to as direct access, should not be considered a privilege but should be a right of Oregon businesses who are looking to cut energy costs, want and need to increase renewable content of their energy mix, will benefit from tailoring the investments into clean energy technologies and maximizing cost efficiencies, and are sophisticated enough to make energy purchasing decisions to best accommodate the way that they, as a business, use electricity. TechNet member businesses greatly value bringing on new renewable power above and beyond Oregon's RPS. Senate Bill 979 removes obstacles inhibiting full implementation of a renewable energy direct access program precisely in the manner our member companies seek. Oregon businesses are ready to accelerate their use of renewable energy, thereby shrinking the utility's RPS obligations while driving down the future cost of clean energy. Our members are ready to invest in renewables. Oregon's 50% is commendable, but many businesses want to go to 100% now and show their customers, their shareholders, and their employees that they are unquestionably committed to adding new renewable energy to the grid, which would otherwise not have occurred. TechNet member companies want to expand in Oregon, creating jobs and tax base and bringing more clean power to the state. Senate Bill 979 simplifies direct access for non-residential customers who want to leave utility cost of service and procure 100% renewable energy. As a result, TechNet members can meet their corporate sustainability and carbon reduction goals and boost Oregon's economy in the process. The need for innovation, efficiency, and choice is clear. Competition is the proven best way to achieve both. TechNet strongly urges your support of Senate Bill 979 and requests you vote it out so the bill can be considered by the full Senate. Thank you.
Linda.
Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Linda Gardner, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Microsoft in support of SB 979. Microsoft is committed to ensuring its corporate operations, both in its data centers and its other corporate operations, contribute to the worldwide effort to convert from a carbon-based economy to one based on renewable sources. Microsoft has had a commitment to sustainability for some time. Since 2007, the company has been tracking and reducing emissions, and it has been 100% carbon neutral since 2012. Microsoft also has a commitment to 100% renewable energy, which it is pursuing through direct purchases of renewable energy and renewable energy credits, or RECs. Microsoft has an internal energy group that secures energy for its global portfolio of over 50 large data centers. The Microsoft Energy team has extensive experience on a range of sophisticated power supply transactions. In its most recent fiscal year, the team arranged over 2.5 million megawatt hours of power supply in over 20 countries, including arrangements in 8 states. For example, Microsoft currently has agreements to purchase in place 175 megawatts of wind energy from the Pilot Hill Wind Project in Illinois, about 60 miles south of Chicago. 110 megawatts of wind energy from the Keachy Wind Farm in Texas, and RECs for 20 megawatts of energy from the Remington Solar Farm in Virginia. We envision Microsoft making similar projects possible in the Pacific Northwest. Wherever Microsoft has facilities, it engages with local utilities and independent power producers to identify sources of local, reliable, affordable, and sustainable energy. Microsoft supports passage of SB 979 because it will accelerate development of new renewable energy resources in Oregon, and because we believe it will enable Microsoft to cost-effectively achieve its sustainability objectives here in Oregon. Thank you.
Chairman Beyer and members of the committee, thanks for giving Walmart the opportunity today to testify in support of Senate Bill 979. My name is Chris Hendricks. I am the Director of Markets and Compliance for Walmart Stores, Inc. I'm responsible for directing and implementing policies for Walmart's retail and wholesale business interests related to electricity and natural gas in the competitive markets of the United States and the United Kingdom. Walmart operates 44 facilities in Oregon and employs over 12,000 people in the state. 10 retail locations currently in the state of Oregon have on-site solar on top of the roof. As a major energy user in Oregon, we support passage of SB 979, which would allow commercial and industrial customers to purchase renewable energy that fits their business needs. Walmart has established aggressive and significant renewable energy goals, including back starting in 2005, as you heard Letha talk about earlier, the aspirational goal to be 100% powered by renewable energy. Aspirational, one day hopefully we'll get there. So what we've done in the meantime is have some incremental goals to get to that point. The first one was to produce or procure 7 billion kilowatt hours by 2020. So we're on our way to get to that part. The next one that we announced last fall is by 2025 to be supplied by 50% renewable energy. Additionally, Walmart has set a science-based target to reduce emissions in our operations through the deployment of energy efficiency and consumption of renewable energy by 18% by 2025. Like many other businesses, renewable energy is becoming more important to our customers, employees, and shareholders. In contrast to monopoly utility companies that are guaranteed recovery of their costs from captive customers, businesses that elect to participate in renewable energy direct access will bear all of the risk and cost of participation, not any other ratepayers. The amount of on-site renewable energy production capacity will not be enough to meet our internal goals currently. Therefore, in order to reach them, we need to have access to wholesale renewable energy projects. Walmart supports Senate Bill 979 and recommends the committee pass the bill out of committee. Thank you.
I'm curious. You're a big customer, and you're probably one of the more sophisticated in the West. Why aren't you a direct access customer now?
So we haven't to date been able to make it cost effective in Oregon to do it. We do it in all the other states in the U.S. where we have a choice, but in Oregon, because of the...
We have that choice in Oregon now, too.
We do, but from a...
So how would this change the cost-effective piece of that?
This would enable us to buy renewable energy. So currently, if we were to go direct access, we would just buying energy on the market, and it would not meet our corporate renewable goals.
But you could buy from an ES energy service supplier now. As a direct access customer, I think you could do exactly what you're saying right now. I'm just curious.
Okay, great.
Any questions for the panel? Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
Lee's taking the afternoon off. He's going to let me continue to run the meeting, and we're going to bring up Scott Bolton, Dave Robertson, and Brett Sims. Come on up. He's not really taking the day off.
No, we got to pay more attention.
We're not taking the day off either.
All right, good.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, other Mr. Chair, for the record, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. We serve Oregon as Pacific Power, which has about 560,000 customers across the state. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 979. Really quick, I just want to say out of the get-go that we agree with a lot of what our customers are telling us around their sustainability goals to get to more renewables and at a faster rate than we're able to attain within just our normal cost of service system power. We've supported measures before this body over the last few years to create more flexibility and allow the utilities and other parties to provide opportunities for those customers who do want to pursue their energy goals to be able to do so.
And we'll continue to work on that. There's been quite a bit of work done at the Public Utility Commission where a number of these issues have been sorted through and the public interest has been balanced and weighed. And, I think we've made some progress, but there's still more work to do. And I think that eventually we are going to get there to where we can find some sustainable and durable policies that support customers wanting to do this. However, we do oppose Senate Bill 979 because this is, frankly, on its face, not the way to do it. What Senate Bill 971 does fundamentally is it changes that balance of public interest. It shifts costs and risk onto those customers who do not participate in renewable direct access. And let me be clear, to Mr. Kahn's point as he set this up, this is a attempt to try to shoehorn on top of existing policy in Senate Bill 1149, which has been in place since 1999, where there is a very robust set of policies and regulation around how a large customer can elect to go to direct access, leave the utility system, and be served by the market. But what this does is it does two fundamental things. The first is it creates a whole new class of direct access. So rather than what I'll call traditional direct access, which is the law as it is today, this sets up a whole new paradigm called renewable direct access. Well, if you elect renewable direct access, there are different terms and conditions, there are different regulatory applications and costs involved with that are fundamentally different than all the work that's gone into how the program works now. And what that basically means is this is a shortcut and a loophole to try to reduce those transition charges, those costs that would ultimately be shifted to other non-participating customers when a large customer elects to use renewable direct access. And frankly, this whole concept of renewable direct access really gets muddy when you realize that in Senate Bill 1547 last year, the Clean Electricity and Coal Transition Plan, electric service suppliers, so these independent providers, also have to meet the same renewable energy goals as the utilities, as the investor-owned utilities that serve the state. So it becomes pretty difficult to see what traditional direct access even is anymore if supposedly there's now a new class of direct access that is only for renewables. And to your point, Senator Beyer, this is something that's available to these customers today. When a customer does choose direct access and they decide to make an economic decision and leave the utility system, they can choose whatever power supply within Oregon's RPS now that meets their needs, even if that's 100% renewable. That's available today. But really what Senate Bill 979 tries to do is change the rules. It changes the playing field so that the costs that would otherwise be incurred for making that decision. So all of the investment, all of the infrastructure, the power plants, the transmission systems, the substations, everything that goes into supplying that large customer that the utility has invested in would not be fully recovered by that customer as they leave. And so those costs ultimately would be borne by everybody else who's left. And it's not just a situation of kind of the regressivity of a large corporate, well-to-do industrial customer leaving our system and having that fall on just residential customers. I'm concerned about how that cost shifting occurs even within the industrial customer class, where we do have a number of large, sophisticated customers that do wish to pursue higher renewable energy goals, but we also have those that, frankly, don't have those same values or corporate goals, that don't have the creditworthiness or even the business plan that would really support going after and having a long-term contract under renewable direct access. And so those customers, as well as every other customer that would be left behind, would end up bearing that economic fallout. This is something that is an incredibly complex topic. It's something that I know that there's a ton of expertise within the PUC and that they continue to look at and evaluate as they regulate our business and look out for what's ultimately in the public interest. Again, some of the ideas behind this as far as encouraging the opportunity for large customers to pursue their goals and do so in a way that doesn't harm other customers is laudable. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 979 doesn't accomplish that. Thank you.
Go ahead. Lee?
Scott, the harm to other customers you're talking about is really from stranded costs. That's where the transition fees come from. And that certainly makes great sense in, I'll say, the old paradigm, but things are changing. With the passage of the coal to clean bill last time, and the requirement that utilities achieve a higher level of renewables, can't you make the case that if one of your large customers is going to acquire that piece themselves, that that relieves the customers of having to put that in rates?
Senator Beyer, I think, you know, certainly if there is less load as a result of that customer leaving, we would experience that no matter what, no matter what kind of resource choice that customer made. Certainly if a customer leaves to, say, get, you know, power on the wholesale market and don't really care where it comes from, that load loss looks the exact same as if that customer left to go get 100% renewable power. That's just fewer kilowatt hours to sell across. Where I think that there is some real harm is as we invest in the future, and you know, these are pretty lumpy investments. You try to look out a little ways as far as what your needs will be. You know, the integrated resource plan is a 20-year look. And when we invest in resources in order to meet what's forecast in that IRP, we don't know if in year 18 a large load may leave due to direct access. And so if that happens, certainly you know, we bear the consequence of that loss of load, and that investment may become stranded.
That's looking ahead quite a ways. Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions?
Thanks.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Robertson. I'm Vice President of Public Policy at PGE, and with me is Brett Sims, who is our Director of Resource Planning for the utility. And so hopefully we'll be, between the two of us, we'll be able to answer any questions you might have about how we plan the utility system. I don't want to add to what I agree with everything Scott said. We oppose the bill for a number of reasons. A couple of points, I agree with Scott's comments about transition charges, and I don't need to belabor that at all. I think a couple things I would want to add. One, just about what's going on now, PGE has over 200 megawatts of its system out, its customers with over 200 megawatts out on the market now. And I know for a fact some of those are out getting, just procuring regular the market mix, and others are out with a green market product. And so things are happening out there. I think it's a fallacy to say that there's nothing happening in the market. I think the fundamental problem with the bill is it shifts costs and risks to our customers. I think the commission has a long history through and after Senate Bill 1149 over the last 18 or so years of establishing transition charges as a way to make up for the resource planning we have to do to make sure that we've got enough power for customers, not only the customers who are with us, but the customers who want to grow with us and the ones who come as well. We have a Brett here in his department looks ahead. They do look ahead 20 years, but then they develop a five-year action plan. And that plan says in the next 5 years how we're going to meet those customers' loads. So as you know, utilities a bit like a turn in a big giant tanker ship. I mean, we kind of get moving in the direction. We have to work on power plants and transmission and these long-term investments to make sure the lights stay on. And those investments take a long time and have a lot of lead time. So when a customer wants to get out of the system, the transition charges that the commission has established allow for the customers who are still on the system not to get stuck with costs. Two other points I want to make about the bill that I think cause a lot of confusion and unintended consequences. The way the backup power is required now, and when a customer goes to market, if their marketer defaults on them and they have to come back to the system, we have to bring them in. It's called provider of last resort, and that was a fundamental part of 1149 when the legislature passed it, to make sure that if a customer is on the market, they don't get stranded out there and can't have the lights go on. We always have to make sure that they're adequate. The bill, and Senate Bill 979, essentially puts us and our customers over a barrel. And it says that if a customer goes out and a marketer defaults and that customer all of a sudden can't get power, when they come back to us, the only way that we can back up power from that marketer that failed is to go to the market to get that power. Now, part of that problem can be, well, is there any power available? What's the price of that power from that marketer? Is that marketer going to game the system and enable, is it the same marketer? Are there multiple marketers? I think it kind of puts us in a very difficult spot. The other thing
Dave, if they come back under 1149 direct access, if they come back on, don't they get power at market? They don't get the rate, the utility rate.
They do get the utility rate. So we don't put them on an index, or there's no special rate for customers. We're unable to have those special rates as part of 1149. Anything else you would add to that?
I may be wrong on that. I thought they came back on at market.
Chair Beyer, committee members, my name is Brett Sims. My recollection is that it is correct that if that direct access load comes back to the utility because they've lost their provider, the utility has an obligation to provide electricity to that customer, but at a prevailing market rate. Now, the issue with that is there power in the marketplace, and how scarce is it? During times of very high demand, it may be very difficult to find, and it could be at a very expensive price. We are not able to differentiate adversely against that ESS customer that may have to come back to the utility. So whatever costs or whatever implications might occur in terms of our ability to find power, that risk is borne effectively by all customers, because there's no guarantee we'll find the power.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Were you done? I didn't want to cut you off.
All done. Yes.
Address a couple of things. I can't remember if it's 2013 or 2014. At PG's request, the legislature passed a bill that would allow you to provide special rates to customers, who wanted green power. And my understanding is that we apparently didn't do that very well, because the PUC had some problems doing that. But I assume that seems to indicate an interest in doing that, which I think makes sense. That's one. And the second part of the question is, when we passed 1149 in 2001, when we finally did it, part of the issue was, before that, utilities used to have a number of special contracts that would be sort of one-offs negotiated for each industry, and we eliminated that. This seems to be a movement back towards that. Can you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Dave Robertson again for the record. In 2013, I believe we passed what's called the Voluntary Renewable Energy Tariff Bill, which would have allowed the utilities to go to the commission and develop a tariff. One of the main issues with that was that it was permissive to the commission, that they had to go forth and see if it made sense to allow the utility to offer and under what conditions. And so one of the main conditions was that costs couldn't be shifted between the customers going onto the voluntary renewable tariff to the costs that were the customers who were existing. And I think that it was a very long docket. I think it went multiple rounds. And ultimately, I think we found with the rules that it was not cost effective to be able to offer that at the end of the day for us. As far as a special contract, you're correct in that in 1999, previous to 1149 and electric restructuring in Oregon, a utility could work with a particular customer to set up a special rate for that customer, depending on their load and other conditions. And so that was eliminated, so we no longer have that option.
Yeah. Just one thing that I'd add is, in the earlier legislation that set up the very robust PUC process to look at how to provide a green energy product for a large customer who elected to be served by that rather than general service from the utility. Part of the reason that was so drawn out and there was so much complexity to that was precisely the issues we're talking about today, which is, how do you ensure, and in fact the legislation itself had baked into it, that the commission should not allow cost shifting among customers when these other alternative contracts were selected. And that continues to be, I think, a pretty tough code to crack, but it's one that with additional work at the PUC, we may be able to make more progress on. What this does is it basically circumvents those issues. It basically says, don't look over here. Transition charges are what we say they are from now on, from the people who want to move in this direction, and takes that deliberation and that calculation of what is actually fair and what's the true cost that could be shifted among customers off the table. And I would also point out that under the earlier legislation that started that investigatory process, it was neutral as far as ownership of the resource or where that supply came from. The utility had the opportunity to be able to provide that 100% or above and beyond green energy. So did independent power producers. It was neutral to what that ultimate product would look like, because ultimately that would be determined by the customer themselves. I've worked a lot with Ms. Tawney and her organization over the last few years, and we've met with a number of these large corporate buyers and companies that we serve. And what I can tell you is in every one of these conversations, their vision of what exactly their green energy solution looks like is different. Each of these companies is differently situated, has different goals, has different appetites for risk and cost. And so you ultimately have to explore whether you are getting into special contract territory in being able to deliver these types of products.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're all hearing from certain large customers predominantly who, for probably market reasons, are being, their customers are demanding that they demonstrate that they're into the green business. You've asked, or at least through PG, you've asked for a way to do that. Didn't work, and that was for various reasons. So I seem to think you're saying we need to find a way to do that, and maybe it still is a special contract. But the issue then is really one of how to treat the transition costs, whether they're really a stranded cost or not. That kind of gets to the nut there, which may make it whether these are, regardless if an independent power producer is providing it or you're providing perhaps through an independent power producer for them, there's still the cost of the transition and making sure that other customers aren't paying for that. Is that the point?
I think that's a good way to capture it, okay. Senator Beyer.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Bring up our next panel, Brian Sheehan, J.L. Wilson, Jeff Bissonnette.
We got a whole bunch.
When did you call up? I thought the whole audience was coming forward to the table.
Did he scare you?
No, just running out of chairs.
Go ahead.
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Brian Skane. I'm the Executive Director of the Community Renewable Energy Association, or CREA. Appreciate the opportunity to speak today and testify in support of 979 with the amendments. CREA is an Oregon Chapter 190 organization comprised of 15 counties, 3 irrigation districts, 1 city, a number of small private power developers and individuals and farmers supportive of small community-based renewable energy projects. CREA's members support opportunities for development of power generation by independent power producers and the ability of Oregon's businesses and industries to have flexibility and freedoms to purchase renewable energy by non-utility renewable power generators. CREA's members are extremely interested in rural economic development. Our experience indicates that potential new customers in the electric load are increasingly interested in meeting their corporate or business goals through procurement of renewable energy, at times participating in the renewable energy development themselves. To the extent that Oregon's policies and their investor-owned utilities inhibit or discourage those choices, we believe we disadvantage ourselves in competing for new businesses and associated jobs and tax base. CREA is supportive of the passage of 979 with amendments. We believe that the passage of 979 will finally realize the goals first established by the passage of Senate Bill 1149, clear back in 1999. That bill was intended to provide non-residential customers in Oregon the ability to purchase power from non-utility entities called energy service suppliers. In the almost 18 years since the passage of 1149, Oregon has seen at best modest progress in giving customers more choice in choosing their power supply and independent power producers a market for their product. Most recently, the legislature passed 4126, which directed the Oregon Public Utilities Commission to implement a voluntary renewable energy tariff. Unfortunately, this effort once again resulted in frustration as no such opportunity for customers was clearly established. At this time, it appears that there are only approximately 45 commercial and industrial customers who have found a way to purchase power from amounting to approximately 4% of Oregon's load from these energy service suppliers. CREA believes that these numbers, combined with the fact that we're still having this discussion 18 years after the passage of 1149, makes the need for Senate Bill 979 apparent. CREA members pay rates to investor-owned utilities and are not insensitive to the possible rate impacts discussed by the previous panel on customers who remain cost-of-service-based rates of those utilities. We believe that the protections for the remaining customers through the termination of transition charges or exit fees are fair and reasonably balanced in 979. 979 allows exit fees but requires IOUs to use diligent efforts to mitigate exit fee costs to consumers and limits the duration for which those fees may be imposed upon the customers departing the IOUs. We support 979 and believe that the amendments reflect an appropriate willingness to work with other stakeholders to improve the bill, and that's commensurate with Bob Kahn's earlier testimony. In closing, CREA supports 979 with the suggested amendments. We believe that 979 provides customers with additional flexibility and freedom to have control over their power supply, creates additional opportunities for businesses to develop additional renewable energy, enhances rural economic development opportunities, and reasonably protects customers staying on traditional IOU power supply service. I appreciate your consideration today and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Byer, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. ICNU supports customer choice to the extent that other customers are not negatively impacted by those choices, and as such, we support Senate Bill 979. Many of our members are increasingly interested in procuring renewable energy to power their operations and want to be able to choose where and how they source that power. Senate Bill 979 meets these objectives of providing customer choice while insulating non-participating customers. In our view, the IOUs are not currently able or willing to provide this choice themselves. The House Bill 4126 from 2014 has been alluded to in previous testimony. The PUC found with respect to the voluntary renewable energy tariff that such an offering could not eliminate cost shifting to non-participating customers if these utilities owned the renewable resources. And in our view, the utilities were unwilling to develop a VRET that did not result in their ownership of the resource. Senate Bill 979 overcomes this hurdle by mandating renewable direct access and prohibiting the IOUs from owning the resource. And furthermore, we believe that the limited five-year transition charge is appropriate and sufficient to protect non-participating customers from the cost shift. And because of that, we support Senate Bill 979.
So why 5 years? I mean, that seems like that's an atypical amortization time period. Most of the rate cases, the amortization is 20 or 30 years.
Thank you, Chair Byer. I don't know the answer to that question. I know that 5 years is a practice today, we heard, with one of the IOUs. And so I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Jeff Bissonnette representing the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, the solar trade group for the state, also testifying in support of Senate Bill I just blanked on it. 979. It's palindrome. Works both ways.
This bill would be fine.
yeah, I think, and just to add to some of the discussion, I do think that this bill is a continuation of the conversations that have been alluded to, and going as far back as 1149, and how do large customers that have specific needs, how are they able to meet those needs and not harm other customers? You know, I think that the area of corporate procurement, which in the renewable sector is, you know, kind of the industry name for this activity, is to try and figure out how to get these customers the renewable energy that they want, you know, as a differentiator, as a way to show their customers that they are addressing those customers' concerns about climate, about environmental responsibility, and, you know, that is something that they have, you know, put as part of their corporate plan. I think that is, again, we've talked a lot about the voluntary renewable energy tariff, and have, as someone, you know, who that was probably that year and a half was probably about the five longest years of my life, and it was unfortunate that we couldn't, you know, reach some sort of workable solution. I think that if we are able to work with this bill, and I think everybody agrees with the principle of protecting non-participating ratepayers, of making sure the transition charges are covered, and to your question, Mr. Chair, I think that even within today's direct access program, you have, you know, different periods. I think in one utility you have 10 years worth of charges covered in 5 years. I think you have in another utility more like 5 years covered. So I think that it's an arbitrary length of time, but one that is estimated to capture the costs that are being left behind. I think we are also seeing the advent of new load coming on, and to the extent that it is new load that is unexpected, that hasn't been planned for, that load might need to be treated differently, and that's something that I think even direct access didn't necessarily consider. So I think that, again, this is the next stage in both direct access and in providing larger customers the renewable resources that they want to pursue, and frankly, for solar energy developers and other renewable energy developers, it's an opportunity to build more resources and dedicate those resources to the customer that customers that want them. So in conclusion, I hope that we have the opportunity to continue to talk about these issues in this bill, and that you as a committee see the merit in continuing the conversation and look for a way to move this bill forward. Thank you, and happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Any questions? Thank you. Got a couple of panelists left. You have about 15 seconds each. Come on up. Carl Fink and Marcy Grail. I was just kidding about the 15 seconds.
I'll give you 30.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee. I wanted to offer myself up to testify as the primary drafter of this legislation. I was also one of the primary folks working on the VRET bill for those long 5 years. And I believe I can answer a lot of the questions that have come up today. I want to highlight a couple things in particular. First, with respect to the transition charges, I want to be very clear that this bill fully encompasses transition charges. There's no proposal to keep to throw additional costs onto remaining customers. Transition charges will be reviewed by the commission, and they will be set. There are a couple distinctions between the way transition charges are set with the standard direct access and renewable direct access. For example, with renewable direct access, we're proposing that new load, think a large data center, think a load that would not otherwise come to Oregon, is going to come. That is not something utility planned for. Right now, those entities in Pacific Core system would pay 10 years of transition costs lumped into 5 years, which is what makes this so uneconomic to do with direct access getting to one of Senator Beyer's earlier questions. The costs of current direct access become unworkable, and therefore, although you can actually purchase a green product, it becomes just economically unworkable. So, as an example, in this proposal, just for green energy, we're proposing that new load that wasn't in the utilities plan does not pay transition costs. Again, think load that was not something, this is not organic growth, this is a new plant that is coming in. And if you look at the statute, we talk about demonstrated by infrastructure development. These are dollars spent in Oregon and putting steel in the ground to create this load. Second, a point about the VRET and what happened in that docket. The VRET was proposed, and the commission came out with an order that required the utilities to, if they wanted to offer a VRET, to do it under similar terms as direct access. Now, the utilities chose not to offer any program. That's part of why we are proposing this now, because we've heard from a number of customers that opportunity to purchase renewable energies is extremely important to them. We need to do something. We are losing competitiveness in the state. We are losing jobs in the state if we don't get this done. The utilities did not step forward, given the chance. We are stepping forward. We have made very small tweaks to the existing direct access program. We have limited them only for people who want to pay for 100% renewable energy. With respect to the utilities issue of whether they need to be suppliers of last resort, I offer a couple things. First, you've heard from some customers today that are some of the largest energy purchasers in the world. And yes, some of these purchasers will be in a position where if their provider of choice disappears, they will have to be on the market. Now, I can tell you that these companies are many of them are large, sophisticated buyers, and this is something they can handle. In addition, there is a very active market for power in WEC. It's pretty standard to buy power on the market. We're simply trying to keep the utilities from having an obligation which will cost everyone more to stand ready just in case someone comes back, which they're not planning to do generally. In fact, I don't believe anyone has ever come back to one of the utilities after taking permanent direct access. No one has ever returned, I think. So to ask the utilities to stand ready so that they can have generation available in that limited circumstance is a waste of money. It's costly not just to it's costly all ratepayers. It's not something that should be encouraged. So the proposal is, yes, if you come back, initially you will have power. We're not expecting the lights to go off, but it's going to be market-based, and there is a vibrant market out there. With respect to the 5 years, I want to note that 5-year proposal is the same proposal as Portland General currently has for all direct access. We're not breaking any new ground here. PacifiCorp does have a longer term, but Portland General, that was their standard. And the basis for 5 years is when a customer says they're leaving a system permanently, if the utility has made prudent investments in something, there has to be some amount of time that you cannot expect them to turn on a dime. But given the fact that there's load growth in the state currently, we know that Portland General is proposing new plants. 5 years is plenty of time to ratchet down those plants. 5 years is plenty of time to have additional load growth. 5 years is plenty of time to find other opportunities to sell some of your assets or reposition them to some other states in which you serve. So there's not a specific magic to 5 years, but it seems that when you're moving forward and looking for what would be fair and reasonable, and recall that direct access, the current law doesn't say there could be no cost shifts. It gives the commission an opportunity to evaluate appropriate cost shifts. 5 years seems like a reasonable amount of time, and so I would choose it. With that, I'll pass on the rest of the time, but as I say, I was the drafter of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any and all questions you might have.
Any questions?
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you. Marcy?
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to address you today. My name is Marcy Brown. I'm an assistant business manager for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 125. We represent approximately 3,300 members who work in the Pacific Northwest electric utility business. Our membership base works for contractors, utilities, and an independent power producer. I listened today, I just caution and ask everyone to consider the actual people who are out there doing the work. Our employer partners, the utilities that they work for, our members get family wage jobs that ensure that they, their families, and ultimately communities have the needed resources to thrive. I'm not certain, as you look at these costs and moving money around and having other people come in, if they're going to be willing to provide those same benefits. Oregonians have always and continue to have the right to safe, reliable, and affordable electricity. And while our system may not be perfect, we've been able to deliver on that obligation. We respectfully ask you to consider whether this bill is absolutely necessary to provide the required safety, competition, and stability expected for the Pacific Northwest. Thank you.
Thank you. Any question?
I think that's it.
Anybody else? Don't see any. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Mr. Eisdorfer, you have a quick perspective? While you're coming up here, let me ask. We obviously have more interest than we thought on this bill. We did not get to 978. When to bring that up? Is there anybody who could not be here on the 5th of April? Wednesday. We have an agenda. Just the utilities? You have people. All righty. Go ahead.
Chair Byer.
I think we will do that. Let me just say, yeah. Is there anybody who wants to comment on that bill today? I don't see anybody, so we will be, just to let you know, we will be rescheduling 978 for Wednesday, the April 5th. Sorry, Jason.
Thank you, Chair Byer. Jason Eisdorfer.
You've heard all this. I'm particularly interested in your perspective on how this relates to or your experience with the voluntary energy renewable bill and why that didn't work and why this might work better.
Mr. Chair,
if at all.
The commission, to be clear, hasn't taken a position on this bill one way or the other, so I'm just trying to provide some perspective, I suppose, from the staff point of view. The VRET, the earlier bill, was different than this. It would have allowed the utilities to make an offering similar to that with ESS and direct access. And so there was a lot of discussion over that year-long period of the relative positions of the incumbent utility and the market participant. And there's some language in 1149 that directs the commission to remove obstacles to the development of the market from vertically integrated utilities. So there were a lot of moving pieces there, and it did ultimately someone before me, I think, said that the commission came up with a list of conditions for the utility and then offered it back to the utility to see if they could design offerings under those conditions, and ultimately both PG and PacifiCorp declined to do that. I guess I would say that I'd make a couple of points in a very complicated area here. One, you've heard a lot about transition charges, and transition charges are not a bad thing per se. In fact, they're a good thing in the sense that they protect customers who choose not to go or who can't go to direct access from uneconomic costs being left behind by those who leave the system. That said, I personally am not really offended by the concept of a brand new load comes on to the system. Is there a special way that they could get access to the market without a transition charge, assuming two things? One is that the utility hasn't planned for that new load and has gone out and made it's created costs as a result of it, and two, that the utility doesn't pick up costs in case of what I would call a market failure if the bilateral arrangement between the customer and the ESS fails. Between those two pieces, I think I'm not particularly offended by having this new load go directly to market. The the interesting thing is, how do you make sure that that utility didn't plan for that load and didn't incur expenses, or that the utility and its ratepayers are protected in case the ESS customer relationship goes sour. There are a couple of aspects in the bill I will admit to you that are not entirely clear to us. For example, a new load is created essentially, but it's not clear if that new load is a new load for all time. So, for example, if a 5 average megawatt new load came on the system and they chose to be served by the utility for a period of time, and the utility made investments on behalf of that customer, is that new load still new load 6 or 7 years from now, where they get to go to direct access without transition charges? So, I think there are some elements that we need to. That we would like clarified going forward. And I think that the one last point I would make, I think as we were reading through this, I think we recognize that the bill in Section 3.1b would create basically a new balancing test. Historically, the commission and statutorily is balancing the customer experience and the utility itself. 3.1b adds ESSs to that, makes it a triumvirate, and there are a number of other different kinds of interests out there that might want to be included in that same kind of balancing test. So that said, we're continuing to look through this bill and trying to understand some of the aspects of it.
If we were looking at this approach, if we're looking at choices, would we look for symmetry, and should we revisit special contracts?
Well, so, Mr. Chair, as I understand this, this bill would further enable customers to go to direct access, so you wouldn't actually – it wouldn't rely on special contracts. This sort of leaves the utility behind and allows, without those transition costs, charges, allows these customers to go to
market. But I guess the question is, if we're looking for if what we're talking about here is providing choices, why wouldn't we look at special contracts that would allow the utilities to be in the game as well, if they could provide a better deal?
So, Mr. Chair, then you have the problem of the utility competing with customers going to market. And so one of the key elements of 1149 was that the utility not be an obstacle to the competitive market. If you now had the utility offering special contracts, why would anyone go to market if they could negotiate that with the utility?
Wouldn't it depend on who would get the better deal, where they could get the better deal?
That's correct.
As long as those rates, that impact of a special contract was not put in rates?
That's correct, Chair.
So what's the problem?
Well, Mr. Chair, the problem was under 1149, the interest and anticipation was that competitive market would develop. And there is language in 1149 that makes it really clear that the incumbent vertically integrated utility can't step in between the customer and that competitive market.
Well, I understand that what's in the law now. I'm asking you, should the law be changed?
I think that I'll let other folks address that.
Oh, I had a cop-out. All right. Any other questions, Jason? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've run out of time. Last chance, anybody else? None? We are closed on that bill. And